The full committee of the House Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order March 11, 2006. We're here today to evaluate the request by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs for authorization for several major construction projects and leases which will improve, renovate, and/or update patient care facilities at various locations. I'd like to thank all of our panelists today for their testimony. The Department of Veterans Affairs must, by law, receive statutory authorization for all major medical facility construction projects and leases that exceed $600,000 per year before it may obligate or expend funds. Secretary Nicholson has requested authorization for $1.6 billion for major facility construction projects and $25 billion for major facility leases in fiscal year 2006. For fiscal year 2007, the Secretary has requested authorization for $352 million in major facility construction projects and nearly $27 million in major facility leases. The Secretary's requests include immediate funding authorization to ensure the restoration and continuation of care for veterans who had depended on VA medical facilities damaged by Hurricane Katrina in Biloxi, Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi, and New Orleans, Louisiana. Those veterans have our support, and we commend the men and women of the VA and the Gulf for their exemplary work providing uninterrupted care to these veterans. Today, we must also look to the long term. Yesterday, the Appropriations Committee declined VA's funding request for the replacement medical facility in Denver. The price, which had originally come in at over $700 million, the price tag has now been reduced to $621 million, which itself indicates that there is a credibility gap insofar as the facility pricing goes, and we're interested in the administration's testimony. For those to whom this is a disappointment and or a surprise, we must all recognize the need for improved facilities in the Denver area, and I suggest that all of us have a wake-up call and a real opportunity before us. It does not have to cost nearly $1 billion to build a world-class medical center. Just last month, the VA's General Andy Love and General Heiberg visited the new Clarion Hospital in Indianapolis. This is a private sector, leading-edge facility. It's in excess of 170 beds at a cost of $280 million. And having been in that facility, when you look around, it looks like the Four Seasons. While the core services provided by the VA and Clarion differ, as well as some construction standards, there appears to be quite a disparity between the private sector and the public sector's ability to build state-of-the-art facilities at reasonable costs. If the writing is on the wall, we must also have examples of approaches that can lead to a sustainable path of quality of care. We must consider the advantages and the virtues offered by approaches more innovative than the status quo process that goes it alone and misses out on opportunities for greater quality and efficiency. I commend the VA, in particular Dr. Perlin and Mr. McClain, for seizing a great opportunity in Charleston, South Carolina, where the VA and the Medical University of South Carolina have a unique physical and business relationship and have produced a collaborative report. In recent months, the two made progress on this enhanced collaboration, and it will yield improved services to veterans. We now have what is called the Charleston model, and before it could be enacted in Charleston, we had Katrina, and it is now proposed to leverage the Charleston model in the Gulf Coast region. The group's purpose, i.e., the Collaborative Opportunity Steering Group, was to explore the benefits of collaboration, which could include the construction of separate bed towers that share services and some equipment while retaining the identity of a veterans health system. Their April 30th interim report called this sharing, quote, a very positive and exciting prospect that will enhance patient outcomes and efficiencies for both institutions. Innovation is not limited to examples set by the private sector or the harnessing of collaboration between public and private sectors. Government agencies can work with each other to be more efficient. In a sign of progress, a 2002 agreement between the Navy and the VA to share facilities in North Chicago is much closer to being fulfilled. Collaboration between the VA and the Pentagon, as we have seen, is essential for the seamless transition of service members into the VA and back again. We should commend these two agencies for their recent progress in developing an interoperable system of the sharing of electronic medical records, yet there's still more work to be done. There is no denying that medicine has undergone a revolution that has dramatically boosted its potential, but also the cost and complexity. Our response must also, therefore, be commensurate. In the face of examples such as in Clarion or in Charleston, and now perhaps New Orleans, preserving the status quo approach to bricks and mortar should be an affront to the much-proclaimed excellence of the VA's healthcare managers. The status quo approach to the bricks and mortar is certainly not good enough for America's veterans, and we can do better. At this moment, I would yield to Mr. Filner for any opening comment that he'd like to make.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for holding this hearing today to examine the major construction projects of the VA and their lease requests, and to hear about the status of the CARES project. I appreciate that our three colleagues are here, Congressman Baker, Melanson, and Feeney, because they'll provide us insight into the issues of rebuilding in New Orleans and southern Louisiana and the longtime need for a VA facility in central Florida. As you said, Mr. Chairman, I hope this hearing will assist in moving along the provision of health care facilities for veterans in these states. I also appreciate the opportunity to hear testimony from the VA and and two of our veteran service organization about the status of the CARES process. I think this can be a very useful tool if we use it well. The VA should have a comprehensive study of its current infrastructure and its future needs, and if used wisely, CARES can help us ensure that veterans get the full value for every health dollar that Congress provides. I was concerned that many construction projects were held up while we were waiting, longer than expected, I guess, for the CARES report. I am concerned now that plans to accommodate mental health care and long-term care were excluded from the CARES process. These two areas of service are becoming increasingly important. It's been estimated that at least one-third of returning troops have mental health issues. An increased lifespan is creating long-term health care needs for our many veterans. The number of veterans age 75 and older is projected to increase from 4 million to 4.5 million by 2010, and the number of those over 85 will triple to 1.3 million in the same period. So I concur with the testimony of the Veterans of Foreign Wars that these services must be evaluated in terms of their facility needs. These questions are ones I will pose to the VA and hope can be answered, if not today, then very soon. I am interested in finding out how CARES interacts with the administration's construction request. What does the VA plan on doing to enhance services and not just close facilities? Are there any criteria for when CARES priorities will be ignored, as they were right away, for a lower priority project? Though promises were made regarding funding for the CARES process, will the funding indeed be a reality in the future? We want to be certain that the CARES process lives up to its mission and does not leave veterans with a series of empty promises. I hope that the CARES report, after years and a significant expenditure of resources, does not end up on a shelf somewhere forgotten. We must make use of all the research and work that has been done, and Mr. Chairman, I thank you for holding this important hearing today.
I thank the gentleman. Mr. Moran, for an opening statement. Thank you. Mr. Michaud. Opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you as well for having this hearing. Looking forward to hearing my three colleagues, what you have to say, as well as the second panel, and really interested in the whole CARES process, Dr. Perlin, so hopefully you'll be able to address some of the concerns that we have about the inadequate funding. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you. Mr. Rosen? Ms. Berkley? Recognized for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank my colleagues for being here. We appreciate the fact that you're going to enlighten us regarding projects that are probably of particular interest to your constituents. But I want to share my pain and my constituents' pain with you. So hopefully we can all work together on a bipartisan basis to provide the necessary facilities that our veterans not only deserve, but that we owe. As you may know, the CARES report recommended a new Las Vegas VA medical complex that would be built in my district. Today, and one of the reasons I am here, not only to hear about your issues, but to get some clarification as to why the completion date has been pushed back from 2009 to mid-2010 and why the complex won't be operational until 2011. I want to know what the holdup is. In my district, we build 5,000-room hotels in 18 months, and they're ready to go, and we can't build a VA facility of 80 beds. Something is very wrong here. I've got the fastest-growing veterans population in the United States. It exceeds 200,000 veterans now. The need for a medical complex exists, and it exists now. Currently, my veterans are forced to take a shuttle to numerous. There are 10 different locations in the Las Vegas Valley. What does that mean? That means that I've got 80-year-old veterans standing there in 110 degrees temperature waiting for a shuttle to take them from location to location to have their promised and needed healthcare needs met. My veterans have been promised this facility. It's been partially, the money has been partially appropriated. We've had press conferences with the VA secretary in Southern Nevada with great hoopla and great excitement, and they're waiting and waiting and waiting. Las Vegas, as I mentioned, has the fastest growing veterans population. We need this facility now, not 2009, certainly not 2011. I can only imagine what the situation is going to be like in 2011 for my veterans. We simply cannot wait any longer, and I would like to know, as I'm sure you would, why this delay, and without any notification to us. So I'm still representing to my constituents, my veterans, whenever I meet with them. We're online, we're on board, we're going to have this facility open in 2009. I find out I'm complicitous as a liar to my veterans. I don't like that. I don't think you guys do either. Also, with every passing year, the cost of building these facilities continues to increase. We now need an additional $147 million, which was promised to be in the 2007 budget. Lo and behold, when the 2007 veterans budget came before this committee, that $147 million was nowhere to be found, with a promise, well, we promised you 2007. Now we're going to put it in the budget in 2008. Now, how do I know that? And what am I going to do when I go back home and my veterans ask me this question? It is wrong. It is wrong at any time. It is particularly wrong during a time of war to treat our veterans in this manner. When we talk about supporting the troops, when we talk about standing up for our soldiers and giving them the strength they need to continue to fight and defend this nation, then we turn around and do this to our veterans. It's a disgrace. And not one of us, not any one of the 435 members of us should allow this to continue. It is a shame, it's a disgrace, and these people deserve better from us. And I'm anxious to hear your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Berkley. Chairman Brown, recognized for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to echo some of your remarks this morning as they relate to the new vision for VA and the infrastructure that will be required to meet the future veterans' demands for health care services. Okay. In my opinion, there are a few more important things we can do than engage in an earnest discussion about how the department begins to prepare itself for the future. I am grateful that all of those in attendance today will help us better understand what department's construction priorities are, how they match up with anticipated demands for health services, and how we re-engage in the business of building hospitals. As most of the people in this room know, VA has not constructed a new hospital in nearly 15 years. As a result of a good amount of the institutional memory has been lost, and we have to try to reassemble processes that will allow us to build appropriately sized facilities where they are truly needed, and at the same time, be prudent stewards of the taxpayers' money. With that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I have some real concerns about the administration's major construction request. It would appear that we are being asked to provide what I call blanket authorizations for major projects in the absence of any real detailed information about the project. Additionally, the Appropriations Committee has made clear over the last several days that they have real concerns about some of those projects and the spiraling costs associated with them. That's the bad news. The good news is that this committee now has an opportunity to reevaluate the traditional thinking and create new models for facilities financing and construction. In my opinion, some of those models should seek to take full advantage of existing and potentially collaborative relationships with medical universities and research partners, and others might seek to have private or nonprofit organizations finance the construction of new facilities. It's this type of thinking that should energize us all to find new ways of providing for our veterans. The bottom line is that our veterans have real needs, and we have responsibility to identify ways to match VA's infrastructure to those needs. I personally believe a new level of creativity is called for, and I look forward to working with my colleagues to develop some of these new concepts. Again, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for assembling this very important hearing today, and I look forward to having a frank discussion with our witnesses. With that, I yield back the balance of my time.
I thank the gentleman. Before we turn to the first panel, I would I'd like to take a point of personal privilege. And that would be, on a bipartisan fashion, on behalf of my Democrat colleagues and staff, or Republican side and the staff, I'd like to recognize the staff director of the full committee. Jim Larevier, you stand for a moment. To let everyone know, Jim Larevier, I've known Jim for 30 years, is the only person I know here in Washington, D.C. that ever dropped me for push-ups as a freshman at the Citadel. Jim has commanded a rifle platoon in Beirut, lost a lot of good friends in the Beirut bombing as a Marine, commanded a rifle company, he's commanded a weapons company, he served 1 year at the White House, he also commanded the honors company. When you go to 8th and I and you go to EWA, he commanded an honors company the Friday evening and Tuesday's parade. He's commanded the 3rd Force Recon. He's been called to active duty twice. He was recalled immediately after September 11th. He was the operations officer for the Marine Anti-Terrorism Brigade. Jim Larevier presently is the commander of the Assistant Division, 4th Marine Division. He's the assistant commander, which means he's a full colonel in the Marine Corps, and he sits in a one-star, a brigadier slot. Jim has been recalled to active duty. He will be going to Afghanistan and be leaving us soon. He will be the advisor to the operations officer of the Afghan National Army. And that is a three-star position. So you see Jim, you talk to Jim, but you also don't know the contributions that he's done, not only in the past, but also what he's about to do for our country. He will be leaving his wife, Jen, and 4 children, and they will keep the watch fires burning. But we also, Jim, want you to know that we will care for them, and we wish you Godspeed. Mr. Michaud?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would like to thank Jim for his service. I have not known Jim nearly as long as you have, Mr. Chairman, but I have known him for a little while, particularly his work on the Veterans Affairs Committee, and I really appreciate his professionalism, his honesty, and his willingness to work hard for the committee, but also his commitment to the veterans of this country and his service to our nation. Want to wish him the very best and Godspeed, and our prayers and thoughts will be with both him and his family. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Michaud. We have before us today distinguished members, one of our committee, Mr. Richard Baker, representing Louisiana's 6th Congressional District. Richard has been a stalwart advocate for our nation's veterans, and it is a pleasure to have him before our committee today. We also testifying is Mr. Charlie Melanson, representing Louisiana's 3rd Congressional District. He serves on the Agriculture, Resources, and Science Committee and has an interest in lowering the health care costs. Our third witness on the first panel is Mr. Tom Feeney, representing the 24th District of Florida. Mr. Feeney serves on the Financial Services and Judiciary Committee as well as the Science Committee. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome the three of you before the committee. And Mr. Baker, we'll start with you. You're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your leadership in this matter. Certainly, provision of care for our nation's veterans is of the utmost importance to every member of the committee and of the Congress. In this instance, there is the unique circumstance of the natural disaster in Louisiana, Katrina, Rita, they're now lumped as one, and the consequences for the provision of service in light of the tragic devastation that occurred in our state last year. Prior to landfall by Katrina, the VA facility in Orleans Parish served 40,000 patients with 1,700 employees with an annual operating budget of $130 million. Certainly a very significant health care provider in our region. As we move forward, the VA in February of this year issued its own report and recommendation with regard to replacement of that facility with a shared operational management perspective with Louisiana State University. And on its face, it's certainly something that I think is worthy for us to explore to realize savings of joint ownership of food services, laundry, parking facilities, and other operational savings that can be accrued from such a joint partnership. There certainly are benefits to be gained from the academic residences that might be employed or utilized within the VA system for the provision of care. So at all levels, this recommendation makes great sense. But as is often the case in Louisiana, rarely are things as they seem. And there are concerns that have been raised that I would like to bring to the committee's attention as we move forward. There is now a June 1 deadline for a subsequent report to be issued relative to the change in demographics and who the facility might serve. There are now about two-thirds of the patient load returning to the Orleans area for care. What is not determined is whether the permanent dislocation that has already, the temporary dislocation that has already occurred will become permanent, skewing the numbers in the Baton Rouge area above the current capacity of facilities that are located there. I am not suggesting today that this is a Baton Rouge effort to take a facility out of Orleans, merely that we should measure carefully the distribution of the veterans and where they might best be served in making this strategic decision as to how we rebuild. There is a second and dramatically more important revelation that I think the committee should be made aware of. When Katrina struck, Governor Blanco created a Louisiana Recovery Authority to be the interface between the federal government and the state government in overseeing the resolution and rebuilding of Louisiana. That recovery authority on its own created a foundation of individuals who collect resources and therefore engage in important studies to assist the authority in making policy judgments going forward. In a recent engagement of PricewaterhouseCoopers, the foundation received a report relative to the status of health care in Louisiana, and it was very, very troubling. As we began to speak about an LSU-VA partnership, I think it's extremely important for the members of the committee and for the leadership of the VA to be aware of and understand the implications of this important study. Let me just read one line that struck me most directly. The report finds that the charity system, that is our publicly operated health care system, is detrimental to the health of all Louisianians and is likely an important reason for the lower system quality, the high cost, and lack of public and private sector benefits. The report goes on at great length to describe why the system is at fault. Why do I bring this to this committee's attention? Well, what is now being contemplated is an LSU-VA partnership. LSU is the administrator of the charity system. It would be like entering into a three-way partnership for a real estate development and the third partner is bankrupt. We need to be very careful as we go forward. Now, this report has, I think, important implications for reform for the provision of health care going forward. It's estimated by the report that the charity system was underfunded in the last fiscal year by some $350 million. If the VA is entering into a partnership with LSU, we would need to be very careful about the supplanting of resources from one allocation to offset the losses in another. I'm going to be much more direct back in my home state and district. I really believe our charity system should be undone. We are the only state that provides care in this fashion. It is extremely expensive. It results in a dual system for those with money and those without resources, and those without resources are receiving inordinately poorer care. I do not wish to see the implications of irreparable injury certainly extended, maybe unintentionally, to the care of our veterans. We have an opportunity here to do something extraordinary. We can enter into a partnership using private and public resources, leveraging with academia valuable research opportunity, and to raise the quality of care to a standard which few have thought possible in our state in years past. Mr. Chairman, I want to be very helpful as we go forward in this. Getting care restored to its pre-Katrina level is essential, but we should be very careful to deploy valuable taxpayer resources one time in the most effective manner possible, and I hope to be helpful to you and the committee as we go forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baker. Mr. Melanson, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Bhuiya. Richard, does that mean we go on record for national health care? We're friends.
We used to be friends.
Yeah, we used to be just a minute ago. Mr. Chairman and ranking members and members of the committee, I thank you for allowing me this opportunity to talk to you about an issue that's very important to me and the citizens of my district, which is veterans health care. As everyone is well aware, after Katrina, the Gulf Coast suffered many devastating losses. The grief felt by the people of the Gulf Coast is incomprehensible. Hurricane Katrina was the worst natural disaster in this nation's history, followed by the devastation wrought by Hurricane Rita. South Louisiana has experienced more hardship and more loss in a period of mere weeks than most communities, states, or regions face in a lifetime. This is evidenced by the fact that nearly 9 months after Katrina hit, we are struggling day by day to rebuild and recover. This is a long-term project for us, and because of what was lost in Katrina was not just structures, but history, memories, culture, communities, and perhaps, saddest of all, many lives. But the spirit to return and reclaim our place in the world is strong in the hearts of the people of South Louisiana, and though we are down, we are not out, not by a long shot. During our time of need, Louisiana has had many friends who have helped us in innumerable ways in the immediate aftermath of the storm and continuing to this day. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the VA for its efforts to evacuate all of the 241 patients, the 272 employees, and the 342 family members from the New Orleans VA Medical Center. Not only that, but by September 7, 2005, all community-based outpatient clinics in the affected areas were operational, and 5 mobile clinics were sent to Louisiana. The VA's efforts in the aftermath of the storm on behalf of the veterans community was outstanding and will not be forgotten. However, in this period of rebuilding, some are questioning whether the VA Medical Center in New Orleans should be rebuilt. As a result of the immense flooding in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, 2 LSU hospitals, Charity and University, which served as vital health care safety net and only level 1 trauma center in the area, remain closed due to extensive and irreparable damage. The VA Medical Center in New Orleans, which is located a block away from Charity Hospital, suffered a similar fate. In other words, much of the health care infrastructure of South Louisiana is in ruins, and with limited access to health care, the region's entire recovery is in jeopardy. That is why the recent proposal to build shared facilities for LSU and the VA holds some hope. This merger could provide the beds and doctors that the general population needs if the city is to have a chance at recovery, as well as restoring services to the thousands of area veterans who depend on the VA. And off script, while I understand and agree in many ways what Mr. Baker says, I think we can work through these problems of administration. That is a fear, more fear of itself. The burden on our veterans since the destruction of the VA in New Orleans has been enormous. Access to care for them has always been an issue, particularly for the veterans in my district who have to travel long distances for the services they need. The situation has only been made worse in the wake of Katrina and Rita, and every day my office hears from veterans who no longer have a place to go for the care they have earned with their service. Many had to evacuate the area altogether, and with no operating VA facilities in New Orleans, may not ever return. It's a situation that's not limited to veterans. Right now, thousands of families displaced from the Gulf Coast are looking at the recovery progress and trying to decide whether or not to come home. Levees are being fortified in most areas. There are a growing number of jobs to be had. Homeowners can now expect to see at least some payment for their loss of housing, and some schools are starting to come online. A tremendous amount of effort has gone into making that simple list happen, but a family asking itself whether it can move back has to ask the question, where do I go if I get sick? What doctor can I see if I get hurt? The answers to those questions lie in a strong healthcare community. Of key importance is the need to rebuild not just bricks and mortar, but the human capital that it takes to deliver quality health care. The hospitals and LSU system weren't just providers of care, but were also teaching hospitals. Without these teaching hospitals, there's a huge hole in the fabric of medical professionals that are the foundation of a strong health care community. The LSU VA plan gives us an opportunity to regenerate this important component. And again, there is ways. This is a historic partnership for historic times. From an efficiency standpoint, it makes sense. From a fiscal standpoint, it makes sense. And from a moral standpoint, after everything these Gulf veterans have experienced and endured with these storms, it makes sense. I urge the committee to support those efforts to rebuild the health care infrastructure on the Gulf Coast for our veterans and for the rest of our citizens in these affected areas. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Melanson. Mr. Feeney, you're now recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm very grateful for the committee's time and providing me this opportunity. The veterans population in the United States currently stands at 26,549,704 veterans, give or take. More than 1.8 million of those veterans reside in the state of Florida. Our state has the second largest veterans population in the country, with over 350,000 veterans in the Central Florida area alone. This does not include veterans that like to visit our state and a lot of veterans that winter in our state. We call them snowbirds, and they're snowbirds that serve their country admirably, and they need service as well. And yet Central Florida is the largest metropolitan area in the country without a VA medical facility. Many veterans residing in Central Florida average more than 2 hours travel time to get to a VA hospital located in Tampa, Gainesville, or Jacksonville. That includes veterans living in counties like Orange, Seminole, Brevard, Volusia, Osceola, Polk, and Lake. In fact, only 45% of veterans in the Orlando region are within the VA's access standards for hospital care, meaning that 55% are not being treated in accordance with the standards. Central Florida is the number one destination for combat veterans over 65 years of age. It's also the number one area for veterans who have 50% or more service-connected disability. 18% of our veterans have post-traumatic stress disorder. There are 128 active veterans organizations in the Central Florida area alone. We've got a number of great American heroes and people that serve their country ably, been working very, very hard to get a veterans hospital for some two decades plus now. John Kellett, for example, some of the DAV veterans, leaders like Jerry Pierce, Charlie Brenner, Dr. Neil Giuliano, Charlie Price, and George Taylor are all friends of mine that have been working very hard for close to two decades. Also Bill Carlson, Earl Denton, and I could name many more. Orlando and its surrounding area was identified by the VA through capital asset realignment for enhanced services as an area in need of a new VA hospital. At the same time, CARES identified the need for a new facility in Las Vegas, and I appreciate the gentlelady's frustration with the challenges that she has meeting the needs of her constituents. The need was both appropriate and warranted in Las Vegas, and they have received funding and are scheduled to break ground this year, although I guess there are some questions about that schedule, which I'll be paying close attention to. However, a hospital in Central Florida still remains at this point just an idea. Design and planning initiatives have been authorized by the VA, and efforts are underway to select a site that best suits the needs of Central Florida veterans community. Balancing the accessibility needs of Central Florida's veterans with the long-term economic impact the hospital have on the state is essential as we look for ways to leverage funds to maximize investment benefits. I'm delighted to announce to you that the Florida Board of Governors recently approved a proposal for the University of Central Florida to build a new medical facility right in the East Orlando area. As Chairman Brown pointed out, there are huge benefits, I think Chairman Baker did as well, to co-locating a facility with a medical school, and the fact that you can build them at the same time is an enormous opportunity that I hope that the committee and the site selection committee will consider. This will be valuable both to local veterans and the VA, as the medical school environment provides insight into innovative and cutting-edge technology. We also believe we're going to have all sorts of spin-off and collateral biomedical research facilities that will be established in our area. The commitment to ensure the veterans have access to additional resources to further enhance the medical services to the VA is an important one. Concerns have arisen from the Central Florida Veterans Associations in the area that the Central Florida VA Medical Center may not come to fruition in a timely manner. Again, we've waited over two decades, and there is concern that we seem to be falling behind again, perhaps. On May 1 of this year, a public hearing was administered by the Orlando VA Hospital Site Selection Committee. Many veterans accused lawmakers throughout the country, including their own from Central Florida, of dragging their feet on this very important issue of servicing 350,000 unserved veterans. Veterans in Central Florida have been waiting for nearly three decades for a complex that continuously has met with delays. Mr. Chairman, I urge the VA to select a site in a timely manner so that our growing veterans population may finally have appropriate access to a much-needed hospital. Again, I'm very grateful for the willingness of this committee to have me come and advocate on behalf of 350,000 people that have ably served their country, and we would be grateful for any help you can give us in serving these people in return.
Thank you very much to my colleagues for your testimony. And let me start with you, Mr. Baker. The VISN has, VISN 16 has been looking closely at the issue on the demographics issue, and I'm glad you bring it to our attention. And maybe you can be insightful and helpful here to the committee of what is exactly happening in New Orleans. I know a lot of the population came into your area in Baton Rouge. Are people going back to New Orleans, or are they now kind of like where they are because they have new jobs? And obviously the demographics may be changing of Baton Rouge, and this could have an impact on site selection and negotiations with LSU on where we're to work together to build a collaborative effort. But if you could enlighten us a little bit more on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's unclear at the moment exactly the ramifications of the storm. I think in Charlie's district, it's impossible for people to return, but simply St. Bernard, there's nothing there yet. There's no houses. It's not a question of being damaged. There's just no structures. In Orleans Parish, it will vary depending on where one was. The Central Business District, French Quarter, some areas are relatively and modestly affected, while other areas, the lakefront, Lakeview as it's known, or the Lower Nine, utter devastation, and no people are returning. The consequence of this is there are at least 100,000 people that are new to my congressional district that are in any number of housing circumstances, from the infamous FEMA trailer deployment to absorption into whatever available rental market. Many business owners have simply relocated their businesses and bought real estate sight unseen and moved their business operation into the region. From the guesstimates that I have heard, it's that they believe a permanent dislocation as to veterans will be disproportionately low to the general population, meaning they believe that more veterans are likely to stay in the Orleans area for services than would be for a customary analysis of the business community or any other demographic sector. However, about a third of the current service area served in the New Orleans area is likely to be permanently located somewhere in the Baton Rouge marketplace. So there will be an effect, and I'm very anxious to see the professional analysis that I hope will be made available early June to help get a better understanding of the potential deployment. But clearly, it's going to change the market, change it for a long time. And as to the speed of recovery, it is at a snail's pace. Nothing will return to normalcy until we have a significant housing inventory for people to live in, and it simply is not happening. And the desolation is beyond imaginable scope, even entering into this hurricane season. I'd ask everybody's prayers that we be spared at least a year before we have to deal with the calamity of even a modest storm.
Well, you have to go back almost 60 years for our federal government to have had to face major construction projects. We've got 5 to 6 that are in front of us. It's been 15 years since we've built a major facility. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that is left. And it appears that the priority of all of these now is New Orleans, or where? We're going to have to turn and rely upon you for your counsel and also your guidance to the VA, and they also receive their input through the vision and through veterans. We really don't know where for this to go. We're going to have to rely upon you and your counsel. This is about not only where they presently are, but what is the forecast?
And the fact that it served from eastern Texas to a great number of folks from Mississippi, this was a regional facility of great quality care, I might add, as well. And so it replacing it and the services that are now lost is a very difficult task. I just counsel to move slowly and get all the professional advice we can get from any source before making what will be a very long-term decision and one that we cannot easily turn from once the deployment's made.
Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Melanson,
what's your best counsel, not only to this committee, but also, you know, you've got VA leadership behind you.
Thank you, Mr. Bouye. Down the bayou, it's Melanson. Up the bayou, it's Melanson.
Melanson?
Above Baton Rouge, it's Melanchon. Here, just call me Charlie. It's a lot easier.
Melanson. This is De Bouye.
De Bouye.
For those who don't know me, it's Bayer.
Richard and is both our districts have impacted, and for that matter, the entire region has been impacted. And to tell you where anybody has gone is somewhat of a guess. We've got some approximation of numbers, but whether ethnics or VAs or income levels, no one knows that number yet. But I do have a place, Richard, if you'd like, at the intersection of 55 and I-10. We can put it in St. John the Baptist Parish, being facetious. But the need is definitely going to continue. The frustrations, I guess, and Richard has noted the state and its financial problems, that's going to continue on for quite a while. Of course, the federal government and its continuing problems, as noted by Mr. Filner and Ms. Berkeley, there's nobody out there that's got a whole lot of money hanging around, but we have an obligation to all our veterans that we made to them, and it goes back long before any of us sat in the Congress. I will support and do whatever it takes to protect our soldiers as long as they're at war, but I think that we need to make sure that we need to expend whatever capital it takes to make sure that then when they come back, they'll have the medical needs and services taken care of, as they are fully due.
My last question, Mr. Feeney, have you endorsed the site at all since you're working closely with the site selection?
Well, I had not until about 2 months ago, and then in conversations with your staff and with Mr. Brown's staff, we were able to determine that there was one site that apparently meets all of the criteria for co-location. And even before the University of Central Florida Medical School was approved by the Board of Governors. This is now a done deal, and there's funding in the state budget that's been passed just 2 weeks ago. I endorse the site because of the potential and the likelihood of having a co-location, and that would be Site C, which is the Lake Nona site. I should say, Chairman Bouyer, that there is an ICP site that when veterans were asked to testify on the May 1st hearing, virtually all, if not all, of the veterans that testified that because of access reasons that would be their preferred location. And there were a couple questions about that Lake Nona site that I hope that we'll take a look at and resolve that veterans have raised. There's a fourth runway of the Orlando International Airport, which is active right now, and there are questions about things like sound and noise disturbing veterans that have post-traumatic distress syndrome. There were also questions raised about emergency helicopters and whether the flight patterns would be interrupted. I think those questions can be resolved as part of the site selection process. And the bottom line is that with respect to the entire Central Florida congressional delegation, I think including Congresswoman Brown and all of my Republican colleagues, we want a quality site, and we want it as soon as possible. Where is a lot less important to us, and we have the best quality site at the earliest possible time. I think that probably sums up 99% of the feelings of the people of Central Florida.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Filner?
No questions.
Mr. Moran?
No questions,
Mr. Michonne? Ms. Berkley? Chairman Brown? Everybody's being really kind to all of you guys. All right, this panel is excused. Thank you very much. If the second panel will... For health at the Veterans Health Administration, Dr. Perlin's background includes healthcare quality management, health information technologies, medical education, and health services research. Dr. Perlin, you're now recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Pleasure to join you this morning, and I'm joined today by our General Counsel, Mr. Tim McClain, and Mr. Bob Neri, the Acting Chief of Facilities Management for VA. In July of 1999, GAO found that VA was spending $1 million a day on unneeded or unused facilities. In response, VA essentially declared a moratorium on new healthcare construction from 2000 to 2004 to develop a coherent national plan for modernizing our facilities. Capital Asset Realignment for Enhanced Services, or CARES program, is that plan. It allows us efficiency in our healthcare operations and to more prudently use the funding taxpayers entrust to us. And it allows us to transform an infrastructure created for previous generations of veterans into one that provides 21st century care and 21st century technology for 21st century veterans. VA is the owner, tenant, and operator of the largest healthcare-related real estate portfolio in the United States. The department also maintains facilities for the Veterans Benefits Administration and most of our nation's national cemeteries. VA's goal is to always use these resources efficiently and effectively for the service of veterans. Former Secretary Anthony Principi released the CARES decision on May 7, 2004. Since that time, 12 construction contracts under CARES have been awarded and are underway. We plan to award an additional 12 contracts by the end of this fiscal year. Guided by Secretary Nicholson's Blue Ribbon Panel, the Construction Advisory Board, which is chaired by General Heiberg, this board offers recommendations for contemporary, transparent, and accountable approaches to construction. These are attributes amplified by our capital investment process. VA's draft bill to authorize construction for FY 2007 was submitted to Congress on April 5, 2006. In it, we were asking to reauthorize 19 previously approved CARES projects, also for 6 new construction authorizations, and approval of 8 leases and 2 projects resulting from Hurricane Katrina's devastation. In particular, a replacement facility for our New Orleans VA Medical Center and the expansion of the Biloxi Hospital to accommodate the workload from the now closed Gulfport campus. For fiscal year 2007, the President's budget identifies a total of $714 million in capital funding. This includes $399 million for major construction projects, for projects of over $7 million in value, and $198 million for minor construction, for projects under $7 million. It also identifies $85 million in grants for the construction of state veterans' homes and $32 million in grants for the construction of state veterans' cemeteries. VHA's request for construction funding for our medical facilities is $457 million. This includes $307 million for major construction projects and $150 million for minor construction. These resources will be devoted to implementing projects identified in our CARES program. If our 2007 budget request is adopted, VA will have received more than $3 billion to implement CARES to date. We appreciate Congress's and the President's support as we maximize veterans' access to the high-quality health care for which our department is renowned. Let me highlight one of the projects currently funded under CARES, the renovation of our Biloxi VA Medical Center. Biloxi was damaged during Hurricane Katrina, and its Gulfport division was completely destroyed. CARES report called for us to collaborate with Keesler Air Force Base to meet VA and DOD needs in the area and to transfer for Gulfport's current patient care services to the Biloxi campus. Katrina required us to accelerate the process, and with the $293 million emergency supplemental funding we received, we We're proceeding rapidly with our DoD partners to meet the needs of Gulf Coast veterans, as well as service members and their families. We're also working, as you know, collaboratively with New Orleans to bring state-of-the-art medical care back to that city and to the region. In February, we signed an agreement with Louisiana State University to work together to develop plans for new medical facilities, maximizing efficiencies through sharing. Together, we hope to create sharing agreements that will benefit veterans and all the citizens of Louisiana, as well as the American taxpayer. Mr. Chairman, the $53.4 million in major construction funding and the $25 million in minor construction resources that this budget provides for the National Cemetery Administration will ensure that nearly 84% of veterans will be served by a burial option in a national or state veteran cemetery within 75 miles of the residence. The National Cemetery Administration is now engaged in its largest expansion since the Civil War, and is making all national cemeteries it administers national shrines commemorating veteran service to our nation. Thank you for your support in fulfilling our mission of service and honoring America's veterans. Thank you.
Dr. Perlin, well, I understand that the core services and construction standards themselves in the VA differ somewhat from the private sector. How do you explain what seems to be a drastic disparity between the cost estimates to construct a new state-of-the-art facility for the VA and what is employed in the private sector?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that question. I should note that VA facilities are built to higher standards in terms of security. The hardening of the first two floors is estimated to add about 5% to the cost of the facility. I would, however, suggest that the costs are not different when one actually looks at what the VA medical centers typically include. They often include spinal cord injury units, nursing home, and our patient population is an older and sicker, less mobile patient population. Because of the illnesses and complexity of the illnesses and the unique services VA offers, as well as facilities which are not just hospital bed towers but also include substantial ambulatory services, when one actually includes these other factors, as well as the federal labor requirements that are part of the construction process, it actually turns out that our construction costs are on par with private sector construction costs. I think it's fair to say that all of us are reeling from the inflation in not only construction in the United States, based in part on the inflation in fuel and concrete and steel, with expansion in construction worldwide, but also a hospital boom that's particularly affecting the cost of construction in the healthcare industry.
I have here the two collaborative opportunity steering group reports, one for Charleston between the Medical University and the VA in Charleston. I also then have your interim report, April 2006, the collaborative opportunity steering group for Louisiana, in particular the Southeast Louisiana Veterans Healthcare System and LSU. I'd like for you to share with us what you've learned from this process and where are we going from here?
Let me first, Mr. Chairman, thank you and Chairman Brown for the opportunity to set a stage to really look at how we might improve our efficiency, both in terms of capital construction as well as operating efficiency by sharing and partnership. We believe that the Charleston approach to evaluating potential synergies was so successful that we have actually now called it the Charleston model. We did not anticipate to, but because of the natural disaster that was Katrina and its tragic circumstances, applied it very rapidly when we looked at the opportunities for those sorts of capital and operational synergies in New Orleans. And indeed, we discovered that where there is an opportunity to collaborate, we believe that we can reduce the cost to taxpayer and improve the quality of services by creating sharing agreements. We believe that there are some unique opportunities in New Orleans, Louisiana, in the absence of a medical center, but we are still learning. What we learned in the New Orleans model will bring us back to the Charleston model and will take us to another level of granularity as we evaluate potential synergies in that environment as well.
Thank you. My last question on the same subject is, Mr. McClain, I want to thank you for your efforts. Do you have anything to add since you personally participated in this process?
No, I think Dr. Perlin has stated it very eloquently. I think the one thing that I learned from it is that the first thing we have to do is for both parties to be talking on the same wavelength as far as a cost in one facility needs to be based upon the same items as a cost in the other facility. And once you get to that level, which took us a while in Charleston, but now we've been able to apply in New Orleans, then you're able to talk apples to apples, and it really opens up the discussion on both sides. And the one thing about the Charleston model, especially working with Dr. Greenberg at MUSC, was that once you get to that level, both sides open up and are then free to talk economics as to what really makes sense in any particular area. And I think that that really was helpful to us in talking with LSU and getting them and us quickly on the same page. And that's why we've been able to, I think, accomplish the interim report in almost record time. And as I understand it, the final report will be ready on June 1st.
Dr. Perlin, Michael Moreland, who's the director of the VA Pittsburgh Healthcare System, extraordinary individual, a real asset to the VA, and to the gentleman to your right, leading these two efforts to define something anew. Congratulations. With that, now I yield to Mr. Filner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to talk a little bit, if I might, Dr. Perlin, about the use of this CARES process in your prioritizing of projects. Can you first explain to us how the VA develops its annual construction requests and what role now will the CARES report play?
Mr. Filner, thank you for that question. Let me, if I might, start with the role of the CARES report. And, as I mentioned in my statement, we essentially had a moratorium on new construction for the better part of the last half decade. And the CARES was a national inventory of our current physical infrastructure, and it sought to look at whether we were meeting the needs of veterans and whether there was infrastructure that actually was taking resources away from serving veterans. So it provided a plan, a template, a blueprint for 20 years. Now, I should let you know, while this is a schematic, we pay attention to world events, and it serves as a template, but absent any sorts of seismic shifts, I believe it's a good template for where veterans are, and it identifies some very pressing needs that are expressed in our 2007 budget requests and in the CARES projects for new construction that are put forward. I'd ask Mr. Bob Neary to talk about the annual process of prioritizing construction activities.
Did you use seismic shifts metaphorically, or did you?
Well, sir, I certainly hope so.
Me too.
Thank you. We in VA have a state-of-the-art capital planning process that has been developing over the past several years. It relies on linking our strategic benefits delivery goals to the infrastructure needs to support those goals. Some of the guiding principles, first of all, in the prioritization of projects relates to their sound business and economic principles, promoting a one VA vision, the linkage of not only the Veterans Health Administration, but the Veterans Benefits Administration, the National Cemetery Program, alignment with VA strategic goals as established by the Secretary and the Secretary's key staff, and also supporting any presidential management agenda items. Projects are all submitted in the major construction program, what referred to as an Office of Management and Budget 300 application. Detailed description of the project and the economics of the project are prioritized, and then the budgets are established based on the priorities that arrive from that process. There are, of course, instances where, for one or another reason, primarily patient safety or employee safety, might suggest that a project be moved up on the list, or there are some projects that are more complicated and take longer to plan for, and they might not be proposed in total consistency with the priorities. But other than that, we are proud that we stay strictly with our priorities as they're established in the process.
Well, let me just, since I'm not sure I understood everything you said, ask it specifically. You had in your 07 request a project, Columbia, Missouri, that was, and I'm not picking on that district, but it had a priority in cares of 21, or 21 on the list. Why was that chosen as ahead of others with higher priorities? I mean, what, and is that policy clearly stated somewhere, or is it just that's what you decided?
Mr. Feldner, I can take that because I, in fact, bear some of the responsibility for the priority of that issue. As Mr. Neary said, the prioritization of projects is based on, first, our service mission to veterans, second, making sure any special needs of veterans are met, and of nearly equal weight, and then actually a mathematical process is used, is life safety. In fact, the change of circumstance occurred at Columbia, and the operating room is having electrical failures, has some infrastructural failures, and presents immediate life safety and issues, as well as the capacity to continue to serve veterans in that OR.
Well, I mean, why didn't the CARES process take that into account?
I think the CARES process reviewed things, but the infrastructure, there were some failures of the infrastructure that became evident that needed to be addressed, addressed immediately. And while the CARES blueprint, this is a fairly fine point on that and one that you would expect us to pay attention to in real time.
It's sort of frustrating, and I think it needs further explanation probably in the documents that, you know, we've been told for a long time that CARES is going to be an all-encompassing kind of thing. We have to hold off capital investments until it's finished. And then it appears that there are projects that don't appear in the top 10 or even top 20 right after the plan is finished. You're going to build up a frustration or a sense that why did we go through all this if you continue to do that. Do you think that that's a worry that we should have? You didn't respond to it, but
as I said, the CARES is a template. This was a new circumstance or a change in circumstance that affected a particular operating suite and put the patient care at risk there, and it needed immediate attention. Our goal is to be as accountable, transparent as we possibly can. And I do appreciate the opportunity to discuss this particular circumstance.
Thank you, the gentleman. Mr. Moran?
No questions, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Michaud, recognized for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the essence of time, I'll narrow it down to one question. Dr. Perlin, the VA has promised many in Congress an increase in community-based outpatient clinics, assuring us of an aggressive program to build upon these facilities. How many of these proposed clinics does the VA plan to build, activate, or keep open within the next 3 years?
Thank you, Mr. Michaud, and thank you for your support of the community-based outpatient clinics as one of the best ways to provide outreach services to veterans. In fact, in our appropriations or in budget hearings, the Secretary testified that in 2006 and 2007 that there will be a total of 58 community-based outpatient clinics under consideration in terms of developing operating plans. We will get those plans and, from each of the networks and go over those. Ultimately, will be up to and including that number of clinics. There may be reasons additional clinics would be brought forward. I'd be unprepared to talk about years out beyond that in terms of the specific number of CBOCs.
But I have a follow-up question. But what do you do in certain visions where the vision personnel will not submit a plan? For instance, Vision 1, there's only one CBOC that's proposed. However, they will not even submit a plan for VA to consider because they have no money to deal with it.
Sir, you're absolutely correct that the funding for the community-based outpatient clinics comes from operating dollars. Their goal is to bring on the clinics not only in terms of what the operating dollars support, but also in terms of the ability to recruit and match the infrastructure to the patient needs. So they prioritize clinics over time, and I actually, along with my senior team, track the workload, and we know that in particular in Maine that there is an opportunity for one clinic that is coming up this year and addresses one of the areas where there are workload issues that are not up to our standards. The other areas actually are within standard, but we recognize the need for introducing those clinics over time. Again, the CARES plan was a 20-year plan, and in fact, it identified 156 clinics. I think the Secretary has testified to this body that 58 are really under consideration in the next in this year and 2007 alone. So, pretty substantial progress.
In the essence of time, Mr. Chairman, I'll submit the rest of my questions in writing, because I know we do have to go vote.
I thank the gentleman. Well, just for show, there's nothing more important than this hearing, than this panel. So we've got a 15 and a 5, and we're going to come back. They're going to have to wait. I apologize, but we're going to have to come back. So I know you I'll recognize you again. Is that all right? And then I'll go to Mr. Brown. Is that
okay.
Fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin. Following up on the collaborative opportunity steering group process in Charleston, several operational issues still remains unresolved. When can we expect the COG 2 to be established to keep the Charleston collaboration going?
Well, first, Mr. Brown, thank you very much for your endorsement of the approach looking at Charleston, looking at New Orleans. It is a good template. And as I mentioned, we learned a lot in Charleston. We also learned in Louisiana. So I will be returning and asking a group to come together this month to again look at another level of granularity on Charleston.
One further question. Do you agree that public-private partnerships can be a catalyst for modernization and development of a new and improved service for veterans? You support that idea, don't you?
Mr. Chairman Brown, we do support the opportunity for collaborations. We believe that there are opportunities where there are synergies, win-wins. As our general counsel mentioned, that the ability to use a model such as the Charleston model to understand the cost basis of activities for each partner, the opportunity to provide services to one another, to support capital infrastructure, all improve the opportunity to serve veterans and not only reduce the capital cost, but reduce the operating costs over time.
Thank you, Dr. Perlin. I'll wait till the next session.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Dr. Perlin, thank you very much for being here. I'm going to dispense with the niceties because I've got some very specific questions that I need some very specific answers. When are we breaking ground on the Las Vegas complex?
Let me ask our Chief of Facilities Management to...
And please don't tell me sometime later in 2006. We've been saying that for months. It's now later in 2006. When are we doing this?
We're scheduled to break ground in Las Vegas in August of 2006.
Well, gentlemen, turn his microphone on so we can pick it up, please.
We're scheduled to break ground in Las Vegas on the first phase of construction in August of 2006.
You will let me know the exact date of that as soon as you know it?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Number two, when is your estimated time of completion?
We anticipate the current schedule to complete the entire project in August of 2010.
Now, why is that a year later than was originally anticipated?
When the design of this project began with two really nationally recognized healthcare architectural firms, they felt that the design schedule we had established was far too aggressive to be reasonably accomplished. They felt the design would take longer, and that is the primary contributor, really the only contributor.
So we have no design yet?
Pardon me? We have completed the first phase of design, which is called schematic design.
Yeah. How many phases do we have in design?
Three phases in design: schematic design, design development, and then the preparation of the construction documents. And
so where's the difficulty? In which phase? If one is done, is it number two or number three that's causing us the delay?
They felt that in each phase of the design, our schedule was too aggressive.
In what way? I'd like to know what way that's going to be. I know how quickly buildings can go up in Las Vegas. I want to know why this one is too aggressive and ambitious.
Not the construction, I don't think they felt was aggressive, but the design itself. In their view,
I'd like to know exactly what it is, if you don't mind finding out from them and letting me know. And here's another question. If it's going to be, why is it going to take an extra year? I understand that completion is 2010, but we're not going to be operational till 2011. Why the lag? And I have one question after that.
I think the reference to 2011, I assume, relates to the fiscal year.
Can you find that out, too?
This type, when completed in August, should be able to be occupied within the next 2 to 3 months after that.
I would think so. I just attended an opening of a viewing of a hospital in Pahrump, Nevada. It was completed. They did the tours. They disinfected it, and they opened it up, and it's taking care of patients. I need that VA thing, hospital and complex open. We need it now. And now we know we got another year delay. And is the $147 million, and I guarantee, knowing the cost of construction is skyrocketing, that's going to go up before this is completed. Will that money be in the 2008 budget? It was promised for the 2007. It wasn't in there. Secretary Nicholson sat right where you are, Dr. Perlin, and assured me in a not-so-pleasant conversation that this would be in the 2008 budget. Will it be?
Let me state, we have $259 million in the bank to support this project.
I know. That's what I keep telling my veterans.
Obviously, we're not going to start a project and not complete it. We want to get this project open. As you know, we have to bring our budget forward through the Office of Management Budget, and the President's budget is ultimately published. And I wouldn't preempt that, but it would be entirely illogical to assume that we make nearly $260 million investment and not follow through in the timely opening.
That's not my question. My question is, will the $147 million be in the 2008 budget as promised by the VA secretary as he sat in that very seat?
I would have to defer to the secretary's testimony.
Then the answer is yes?
I do not recall the specifics.
I recall it very well.
All right. Well, Ms. Berkley,
yes, sir.
We have about 5 minutes to our vote.
I guess, and so it takes about 5 minutes to get there.
Going to
thank you, gentlemen. I'm very serious about this. We need this facility. Thank you.
We're going to recess for about 15 minutes and return. Committee stands in recess.